Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. On the cusp of adulthood in the early 2000s, the first millennial stumbled into uncertain futures, coming of age at a time of crippling recession. Many were locked into minimum wage jobs, underemployed despite college degrees, and weighed down by student loan debt. Elise Goldbach was among them. At first, she aspired to a life in the Catholic Church, a dream cut short early in college life after a horrible tragedy. She eventually earned her bachelor's degree and was just a bit of paperwork, a little bit of red tape away from her master's when mental illness and the recession took hold. In time, she would turn to an unlikely savior, a job in the steel mill that defined much of her hometown of Cleveland. Her story of this time of her life is titled Rust, a memoir of steel and grit. Elise Goldbach, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
This isn't how your life was supposed to go.
No, not at all.
Tell us about what you thought about as a child and where you have visualized yourself being.
Yeah, so I grew up in a very Catholic household up in Cleveland, and I always envisioned myself becoming a Catholic nun. And so, you know, I kind of had visions of being like Mother Teresa and kind of going to different countries and helping the poor and feeding the sick. And life kind of took a series of turns, and I ended up in the steel mill.
Yeah, you wanted to be important. You wanted to feel like your life had meaning.
Yeah, I think, you know, I grew up in a generation where everyone was kind of told that we're special and that, you know, great things are coming for us. And so I just really wanted to kind of be unique and make a contribution to the world, too.
And you had a pact of sorts with your childhood friends to get out of Cleveland.
To get out of Cleveland, yeah. We assumed that the real world kind of happened elsewhere in the big cities like San Francisco or New York and things like that.
You also talked about the stacks of the steel mill. They're part of your childhood growing up, right? You said you used to drive by them and your dad would point them out. And
yeah, I mean, you know, they're right kind of by downtown Cleveland, so it was not unusual to drive past them. And, you know, even when I was little, I kind of understood that this was kind of pollution and it was maybe not something that you wanted to be breathing in as you saw kind of the smoke coming out of the smokestacks. And so I used to hold my breath as long as I could. And even like I kept doing that until even when I was in college, I would still hold my breath past the mill.
And you never, ever dreamed of going there.
No. You know, I didn't have anyone in my family who worked in a mill or worked those kinds of jobs, so I didn't really understand what it was like. I also grew up learning that, you know, maybe unions weren't the greatest thing, so I never kind of thought of getting a union job. And so it was just completely out of the blue that I happened to apply based on a friend's recommendation, yeah.
I didn't get into a lot of detail about what derailed you in college, but obviously it's extremely important when anyone gets derailed in college and kind of there's a dream deferred or a dream denied or a dream disregarded in your case. But first, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Elise Goldbach. She's written a memoir. It's titled Rust, a memoir of steel and grit. If you have a question for Elise coming up this hour, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So was it your freshman year?
Yeah, it was my freshman year of college. My goal was to get a bachelor's degree and then become a nun. Most convents want you to kind of get some college
education. And you
went to
a Catholic college.
Yeah, I went to a very Catholic college in southern Ohio called the Franciscan University of Steubenville. And within a few months of being there, I was sexually assaulted by two of my fellow freshmen on campus. And kind of the reaction from my fellow students and also kind of the administration at the college was not very receptive. I was told to go to confession. While at confession, I was told that this had happened to me because I didn't love myself enough as a woman. When I brought the incident to the administration's attention, there was kind of like this weird tribunal that took place between me and these men where everyone kind of decided that this had been consensual. And so the men went unpunished. And so it really just put a bad taste in my mouth. You know, I put so much faith in the Catholic Church when I was young and believed that it was this institution of compassion and, you know, helping people when they're in need. And I felt like when I was in need, it really wasn't there for me.
What about your family?
My family was actually very supportive. They, you know, when I called them, and told them about this incident. They came down from college and took me back to Cleveland and got me in with a psychologist who was able to kind of guide me through what had happened to me and help me understand, you know, where I was in the grief process.
And then give us some context about where you were with your mental health at this point and how this contributed to problems or not.
Yeah, so I had struggled with some depression when I was an adolescent, but I was actually doing pretty well when I went to college. Mm-hmm. And I have a history of mental illness in my family. My grandmother was bipolar. My uncle is schizophrenic. But this incident kind of set me off into what's called like a manic episode, which is a bipolar episode that causes you to kind of have delusional thinking, kind of causes you to be really high. You don't sleep. You don't eat. And so this episode kind of really sent me spinning and I kind of got out of control. And so ended up being diagnosed with bipolar disorder shortly after the sexual assault. And so I've always wondered if the two aren't connected in some way, because bipolar disorder can sometimes be triggered by an environmental event. You know? Yeah.
You ended up finishing college, though.
I did. I left that school, but went to another Catholic school that was Jesuit, so it was a bit more liberal and very inclusive and very welcoming.
You went to another Catholic school, but you didn't really resolve your issues with the church.
No. The sexual assault really kind of created a lot of anger in me, and I really kind of stepped away from the church for a long time and decided that I didn't want to become a nun anymore, that I wanted to pursue other avenues. And so, you know, even though I had gone to this other Catholic college, I still didn't go to church, or, you know, when my parents went to Christmas Mass, I would not go with them, and, you know.
And you got a degree in English.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which then you went and got a master's degree. Well, not quite.
You know,
this is really interesting.
Yeah. So I graduated in 2008 with my bachelor's, and there were just no jobs to be had when I graduated. So I kind of spent a year painting houses, you know, just like the exteriors and interiors. And then I kind of figured like I should do something else to kind of wait out the economy. So I applied for graduate school. And then I finished all of this coursework, and in the midst of another bipolar episode, I was not able to get the degree because I had filled out some forms incorrectly.
And I thought that when I first read that earlier in the book that, well, it, you know, I hate red tape, too, and it seemed overwhelming, and I completely but then it really did turn out to be just a couple of pages that you had to refile. It really was almost nothing.
It was, yeah, literally almost nothing. And I think I was just in such a bad place in my own life that it just seemed like this insurmountable challenge, yeah.
I think that's so interesting, though, how you thought about that later in life. And maybe you weren't ready.
I think I definitely wasn't ready. You know, I think that I had worked really hard to get this degree, and I had already had so many failures in the job market and trying to get a job in my field that it felt like a moment of truth, and I didn't want to fail yet again, so it was better to fail on my own terms, yeah.
So just by chance, a guy you were painting a house for said, and you kind of wondered, he was a high school friend, and you wondered, how is he doing? He bought a house, he's got this, he's got that. All he works at the steel mill.
Yeah, you know, house painting is very seasonal work. It's very piecemeal. There was no health insurance. And, you know, I just got talking to this old friend, and, you know, he was doing really well for himself. He was, you know, had just bought a house, and, you know, he showed me his paycheck. And I knew that steelworkers made a lot of money, but I didn't realize how much they make. And, you know, he told me about the benefits of the union, and I had never envisioned myself in that profession ever, but it seemed to make sense to apply.
When I look over the arc of the whole story, I really feel warm feelings for the fact that you went to the steel mill in the end. And it was like this family and this kind of protective, insular society where you could heal in a way.
Yeah, it was like its own family down there. You know, I really made a lot of great friendships while I was down in the mill. And also, you know, you're working alongside people who've been there for 30 or 40 years, and they're kind of guiding you in the mill and showing you the ropes. And you just feel like there's this camaraderie, and it feels like people are always looking out for each other because the jobs are so dangerous that, you know, you always have to have each other's back.
They're so dangerous, but they're also rare. On the first page of your book, you described how one of the older workers told you that you'd won the lottery in getting the jab. What did you have to do to get the jab?
Well, after the initial application, there were several tests that I had to take. Some of them like personality tests, some of them just basic math tests. There was, you know, a physical drug test. There was also something called the sandbag test, where they brought us to this big warehouse and they had all these sandbags lined up and we had to move the sandbags from one side of the warehouse to the other side of the warehouse. And so like everyone's doing this as quickly as they can and they're all sweaty and gross. And then they had us go in this room and talk to each other about the process of moving these sandbags. It was quite odd. But so in the whole application process took about 4 months for me. But there are people who wait sometimes years to get these jobs. You know, they're still kind of in the application pool. And I don't know exactly how many people had applied when I was hired, but I mean, I think it was in the thousands. You know, it was just and only a handful of people end up getting those jobs. So it was very lucky that I was one of the fortunate few.
And then the first, you spend 2 weeks in sort of an orientation period. And a lot of that's just watching films about how dangerous it is.
Yeah, all the ways that you can die in the steel mill, yeah. And it really, it sobered me up and freaks me out a little bit, yeah.
When did you first get into the steel mill?
I started in the spring of 2016, so kind of right before the elections, and yeah.
A lot of people have never been in one. I was telling you before we went on the air, I had been in one when I was following a politician around one day during a campaign thing, and so tell people what it's like in a place like a steel mill.
It's so weird because you see pictures of the steel mill and it's nothing compared to actually being in it and feeling the heat of the metal and just the expansiveness of the spaces. You know, I mean, the buildings are just so huge and enormous. And, you know, usually there's cranes always rumbling kind of overhead and lifting. And so you really have to be cautious not only of what's around you, but what's above you. And just, I mean, the machinery itself is so loud, like you can feel the sound just reverberating in your body. And yeah, you just feel very small and very breakable while you're in the steel mill. Yeah.
And when you were there, there was this guy hanging around. I don't know if his name was Frank or something like that. And he was sort of hanging around. He wasn't really part of the union stewardship who was supposed to be onboarding you guys, but he was hanging around a lot. I think that was probably pretty strategic on their part and telling stories.
Yeah. So he was just an older guy who'd been in the mill probably 40 years. And he was just he eventually had a purpose in the orientation. He showed us how to work the boom lifts, which are like the cherry pickers. But for most of the orientation, he was just kind of sitting in the back of the classroom telling like the horror stories of the olden days when, you know, when it was even more dangerous than it is now. He told us a story about a man who was working in a mechanic working on a crane, and the crane started, the power went on before the man got out of the area, and the crane ran over his head and killed him. So just these very sobering stories that, you know, I had never imagined, you know, before I started working there.
And it was a buddy of his, too.
Yeah, it was a friend. And you could tell, like, that, you know, how close people are down there and how much this job means to them, especially when, you know, things like that can happen in an instant.
You wanted to be a professor of English at a university, and now you're in a steel mill. And I'm just wondering what kind of competing thoughts were going on in your head at that time about, well, what have I done? You know, is this reversible? What does this mean?
Yeah, I definitely you know, wondered if this was the right path and maybe felt a little insecure that, you know, I had these high hopes for myself and now I was in a steel mill. And what did that mean kind of for the trajectory of my life?
And some people said, don't get used to the money because you'll never get away from it then.
Yeah, actually, one of my good friends, he warned me that a lot of people have kind of aspirations and then they get this great job and it's hard to move on to something else because the pay and the benefits are so great.
I'm talking with Elise Goldbach. She's the author of a new memoir. It's titled Rust, a memoir of steel and grit. And it's about her time before, during, and after She worked for 3 years in a steel mill in Cleveland. If you have a question or comment about it, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. In the early 2000s, a lot of millennials were locked into minimum wage jobs. They were underemployed, despite the college degrees that everybody told them, you know, would lead them to a land of milk and honey. They were weighed down by student loan debt. Elise Goldbach was among them. At first, she wanted to be a nun. That wasn't going to happen at a certain point, but she did get her bachelor's degree, and she was just a little bit of red tape away from her master's, but she was sidelined. The recession took hold. Mental illness played a role in all of this. In time, she would turn to an unlikely savior, a job in the steel mill that for her had defined much of her hometown of Cleveland. Her story of this time of her life is titled Rust, a memoir of steel and grit. Still with us is Elise Goldbach. Thanks again for joining us. At this time, when you joined the steel mill, it's 2016, and there's some bitterness about how the magnates are spending their money and flaunting their wealth.
Yeah, absolutely. I started in the steel mill when they were in the midst of a contract negotiation that had dragged on, I think, for 9 or 10 months. So, you know, the union and the company couldn't decide on the terms of this contract. And I think that there was a lot of animosity or, you know, just kind of grumblings in the mill just because the man who owns the steel mill lives, I think, over in Europe. But he had, you know, had this huge wedding for his daughter where
$60 million.
Yeah, I think where everybody got it like a Cadillac or something. Or, you know, it was like in the Palace of Versailles was the rehearsal dinner. And so I think that it was just, animosity because these workers are down in the mill basically risking their lives to make a living. And here they're, you know, having to fight for just basic pay, basic benefits, things like that. And this man who owns the company is just kind of flaunting that wealth. And, you know, I think it puts a bitter taste in your mouth.
It's heavily unionized, of course. You're very protected once you get in. Is it for the first 6 months or there's a period before you actually get into the union?
Yeah, it's 1,040 hours, which is about 6 months. But a lot of people can do it quicker with overtime and stuff.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And you wear a yellow hat.
Yeah, yeah. So you start out in the orange hat, and that means you're not in the union. And when you get in the union, you have the yellow hat.
What did you think about getting into a union coming from a family that didn't particularly appreciate them?
I think I didn't really know what to expect from the union. You know, I'd kind of heard that, the unions weren't that great, or, you know, I didn't really understand what a union did, I think. And I really saw that how important it is, like, not only for pay and benefits, but also the role they played in safety and making sure that workers could voice concerns when there were safety issues, you know, and making sure that you know, the company was kind of always held to account when things did happen. And also just the, like I said, this camaraderie between people was really just great to see. And the way that, you know, people went to the union meetings every month, or, you know, went out with each other after work and really created a sense of family.
Did you feel that right away?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, even when I was still the orange hat in orientation, you know, I think that all these older union workers would kind of take you under their wing and you know, really guide you through the mill and kind of also just give you pointers, you know, on how to keep yourself safe.
So it was, though, a different culture. A lot of guys.
Yeah, there. It is still predominantly male. You know, when I started orientation, there were about 25 people in the class, and I was one of three women. And, you know, we started by going to learn how to drive forklifts. And, you know, there's the women and I were, struggling to figure out how to drive this piece of machinery we'd never driven. And the men are, standing around with their arms crossed saying things like, oh, female drivers. Mm-hmm. So you get some of that. Mm-hmm. But more often than not, I think people would try to be helpful and inclusive and also respectful. At one point, I learned how to run a crane. And when you're in a crane, it's a very small, tight space. And, the man that I was in this crane with, we're kind of rubbing shoulders. And he was always just very respectful of my body and my space and apologetic if he happened to bump into me. So, yeah, it's more good than not.
There was an incredible, I thought it was really interesting. You couldn't probably get away with it in a lot of places, but the nicknames.
Oh, yeah, you couldn't get away with it.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you told a really interesting story about Dogface.
Yeah.
Which is kind of shocking to you at the time, too.
Yeah, yeah. There was a woman that people didn't necessarily like her. She had kind of had a trouble getting along with other people. But they called her this horrible dog face name, which, I mean, is just so...
It's horrible.
As a woman, it just makes you cringe. And I was still new at the mill and still kind of green. And I think I told someone off. I said, you can't call her that. And this, older man. And he listened to me. He was actually
so
receptive.
Gosh, I guess you're right.
Yeah,
it's horrible.
Yeah, yeah. And there was someone who called me Quack Quack when I was there because he said I waddled like a duck. So it was like just kind of these horrible things. And like the thing is, you can't really take it to management because then you're seen as a snitch. So you've kind of just got to stand up for yourself and show that you're not going to take anybody's names.
My guest is Elise Goldbach. She is the author of the book, Rust, A Memoir of Steel and Grit. She's going to be at Gramercy Books in Bexley tonight. For more information, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question about her life as a steel worker and how she got there and how she left it, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. And then I loved the kind of the name at the end, right when they were getting ready to disband your unit, Schmo, Joe Schmo. Tell us that story.
Yeah. So I was on a break at the steel mill and I was kind of playing around on my phone, I think reading the news on my phone. And one of my bosses caught me and she said something along the lines of like, oh, you don't want to be playing on your phone like Joe Schmo over here. And the funny thing was that once she left the room, all of my fellow union workers just started harassing me about this name and calling me Joe Schmo and kind of turned it into like a badge of honor in some way instead of like this insult that the boss had intended it to be. And so I kind of, owned it. They, joked that they were going to write it on my helmet. And, so I just kind of embraced it.
By then it'd been, you're going on 3 years at that point. So you understand the culture a lot more.
Yeah. And feel more a part of it and have, the friends that we played crossword puzzles and joked around.
What about women to women?
There's a lot of support, I think, between the women. I think that we look out for each other a lot. There was also a group, like an offshoot of the union called Women of Steel, where, women would kind of get together and support each other. But, there were still things that, we had to kind of fight for. At one point, the union created a softball team, but it was a male-only league, so the women couldn't play. And then the men were like, well, you guys can go and hand out water bottles at the games. And we're kind of like, oh, do you see how that's worse? So right. And so I think that just having that kind of camaraderie between each other and being able to look out for each other and be there.
That you were sort of an object of interest as a young female, and I mean that in the best sense. Some men at the mill, they really wanted to understand where your head was at and where you were coming from. And there was one guy that you met who kind of kicked off the conversation with, why are you are you one of those crazy feminists? And I was wondering, I wanted you to tell how you negotiated that conversation because it led to something quite profound.
Yeah. So, it's never a good conversation that starts that way.
Yeah, right. Are.
Yeah. And so I was a little nervous and I just tried to be as rational as I could. But at some point I got frustrated and and kind of said, like, you know, you can't possibly understand what it's like to be sexually assaulted or to be in that type of position, you know, kind of referring back to my what had happened to me in college. And the man said, you know, no, I think I can understand that. And I got a little angrier. And, you know, it was like, you can't possibly, you know, understand this. And then he told me that he had been molested as a child. And, you know, it kind of really made me realize that we're not always as different as we might think, and that, you know, sometimes people can understand each other in a way that maybe we don't necessarily always understand or appreciate. And the strange thing was that was not the only time that that had happened to me in the mill. There were other men who had told me similar stories. And I think because I was open about my own story, they were willing to share their own experiences.
And it helps just to share a little bit.
Yeah, I think it does. And I think it helps us also to see that, you know, I had assumed that this man was just a regular old, you know, conservative Trump supporter, you know, who couldn't possibly get my perspective. And here maybe we had more connection than I was allowing or assuming that we had.
Did they tend to be just conservative, you know, that kind of us fall into that stereotype?
There were definitely a lot of people down there who were conservative, although there were a lot of millennials like me who were on the more liberal side of things, you know, and there were old timers who would shake their head at Trump, too. So it was a pretty good mix of people, I think, in political views.
The election of Donald Trump, the presidency, was traumatic for a lot of women around the country. We know that. That's not like I'm just, you know, thinking it is. It was a fact. Everybody knew somebody who was literally distraught. And a lot of it were women who had been sexually assaulted in their past and felt like this didn't matter, apparently.
Yeah, and I think I felt very similarly, just, you know, especially with many of Trump's comments before and after the election. Just, you know, it reminded me back to my freshman year of college when the university kind of sided with the men and, you know, allowed this kind of behavior to go on and take place. And it seemed more of that affirmation of this kind of, you know, very misogynistic culture that, you know, is so entrenched.
And where were you emotionally, mental health wise at that point?
At that point, I was not actually doing very well. The steel mill has a lot of swing shifts, and mostly it's, you know, where you're switching between nights and days, and it's often very rapid, you know, like in the span of a few days, you'll switch your shifts. And you're also working like mandatory overtime, sometimes 60, 70, 80 hours a week. And as someone with bipolar disorder, the one thing that you don't want to do is be sleep deprived. That's like a sure way to kind of make your mental health decline. And that's kind of what happened to me. I was working all these shifts. I was still in that probationary period, so I didn't want to request a different shift.
Right.
And so I was kind of sent into like a mixed state bipolar episode, which is where you kind of have like the highs of mania and the lows of depression. So you're kind of delusional. You're also very suicidal. It's a very messy place to be. So I was not doing well mentally or emotionally as this election was going on.
How did the union take care of you through all of this?
I mean, the union was great and super instrumental in helping me. After I kind of ended up in a hospital eventually, and the union was helpful in getting me a regular shift, like a daylight shift, and I went to work in a different area of the mill.
You know, I got the sense when I was reading about that when you returned, there wasn't like people staring at you sideways.
No.
It just was a vibe. I was kind of waiting to see what sort of reception you would get when you came back out of the hospital, and you just moved on. It isn't something that you addressed.
Yeah, no, I kind of tried to just move on, actually, because when you talk too much in the mill or dwell too much on stuff, people pick up on it. And, you know, we call the mill the rumor mill because everybody kind of gossips about everything. So I'm sure that there were people who knew what had happened, but I just kind of tried to like barrel forward in the hopes that everyone would kind of follow behind that.
Yeah. And they did. And
yeah, they absolutely did.
Jim in Columbus, you're on the air with author Elise Goldbach. Welcome, Jim.
Hi. My question is, did your demeanor with management change after you received your orange hat?
So it's funny. I would say that my demeanor did change when I first started, and I was still in the probationary period. A boss told me, like, you know, don't let the mill change who you are. You know, I see it 100 times. Someone comes into the mill and they're bright eyed and bushy tailed, and then they kind of get a bad attitude. And, in the beginning, I worked really hard and was very much trying to please the management. And eventually I kind of learned that sometimes the management wasn't very, they didn't really recognize hard work all the time. And so it was kind of frustrating to do your best and not really be acknowledged for it. And sometimes I was even like punished along with other people. So I was like, well, where's the incentive in that? And so I think I just became more cautious around management and much more, you know, protective of myself and my time and my safety.
Jim, thanks for that call. You know what Jim's talking about, though, when he brings that up.
How
your status changes.
The kind of the animosity?
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say that I had animosity towards the management. But I was definitely more leery of them when they would ask for things or when they would talk to me. They were generally tried to be pretty supportive and everything. But sometimes they would ask you to do things that were just not safe or good.
There was a guy that I didn't recognize at first that he was part of management, Frenchie, mm-hmm. who repaired things. And I thought that was interesting. He wasn't in the union.
No, he wasn't. He was one of our bosses, technically.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think that with Frenchie and others like him, he had been in the mill for so long that it was like he was a fixture and kind of a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there is still that, you know, whether you're management or union, it's still such a dangerous job that you do kind of still respect each other.
You're all in there together, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And while you maybe don't trust everything management says, you still, at that basic level of kind of looking out for each other, you still do that.
And he died while you were still working there suddenly.
He did. He suffered a heart attack while I was there.
It kind of fit his sort of frantic, get out of my way, everybody start working, do something, quit looking at me, you know, kind of a personality.
Yeah, he definitely was like very sharp and biting and, you know, yeah. always kind of with his arms flailing, I imagine him. But it was very, very sudden.
And people were saddened by it. It was important.
It was very sobering. And, you know, we were all worried when the ambulance took him away. And we were all, you know, mourned him after work, you know, and when we heard the news.
My guest is Elise Goldbach. She is the author of a new book. It's titled Rust, a memoir of steel and grit, and tells of her 3 years in a Cleveland steel mill. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The first millennial stumbled into uncertain futures at the beginning of the 2000s, coming of age at a time of crippling recession. Many were locked into minimum wage jobs, underemployed despite those college degrees that everyone said would get them where they needed to go, and weighed down by student loan debt. Elise Goldbach was among them. She would turn to an unlikely savior at the time, a union job in the steel mill that defined much of her hometown of Cleveland for her growing up, and certainly a place she never dreamed she would end up working. Elise Goldbach is the author of Rust, a memoir of steel and grit. And thanks again for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What was you had a boyfriend who's now your husband.
Yes.
That's a spoiler alert.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. But it wasn't clear. He was sort of caught in between these two worlds in a way, right?
Yeah. So, you know, when I went to work at the mill, it was so demanding on my time. So, you know, that's hard just for any relationship to kind of, you know, balance life and work and everything. And but also because the mill had this effect on my mental health and I was just kind of declining. And here we weren't spending time with each other. We weren't having, you know, the kind of good moments. And we were having all of this kind of tension from the mental illness that eventually we kind of, you know, had this breakup that you know, was
lasted several months, right?
Yeah, it did. It did. And eventually we were able to kind of come back together from that event and become stronger from it. But
you were pretty clear with him when you said, are you ready to take this on? You had a really realistic view of your mental illness at that point and what you were dealing with.
Yeah. And I think I always, tell a potential person that I'm dating about bipolar disorder. But I think a lot of people don't understand what it entails. And I think that maybe he didn't quite understand what it entails until I had this episode. And so I think then when we kind of came back together, I was able to say, like, you know, this is what it is. This is, you know, I can do the best that I can to stay on medication and be responsible that way. But sometimes it just comes back. And so I think that he was better able to make that commitment. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just very openly discussed. And he came on board acknowledging that and saying it's worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, you know, that also I think I needed him to be more involved in kind of managing that illness and you know, learn to educate himself and kind of, you know, also understand and listen to me when I would tell him what I needed, you know, and just kind of having more of a back and forth between each other.
You know, your demeanor, I mean, it matters a lot when you're in a place like the steel mill. And I got the feeling that maybe you didn't come across strong enough at first for a lot of people. There was one woman, I can't remember her name, but she shaved her hair and tied on one side and dyed it blue on the other. And at the time, that was, nowadays it's not that big of a deal, but at the time, lots of piercings, that sort of thing, and very, very gruff.
Yeah, people called her Tackle Box.
Tackle Box, right.
And yeah, she was a little bit younger than me. And, you know, she was just a very strong personality, very low, like gruff, kind of angry. You know, if she didn't like you, you knew that she didn't like you. I was always a little afraid of her because I didn't want her to make me cry. and so I would avoid her.
She would
her.
Totally not respect that.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't use the F word on air, but there you had to throw a few of those around to kind of prove yourself to her.
Yeah, I think that when I finally kind of stood up for myself and really asserted myself, I think that kind of changed her opinion of me. I think for a while she thought that maybe I was a little hoity-toity because I was usually so quiet. And I think that when I kind of got down into the grit with her, she realized that I was okay.
Did it matter that you had the degrees and you were just a heartbeat away from your master's? Did that matter to people?
I don't think so. I think that, you know, they always kind of assumed that I might not stay at the steel mill for my whole life, that I might kind of move on. But there were actually like other people that I met who had both bachelor's degrees or master's degrees. There was one woman who was practicing psychologist before she kind of came to the mill. She just got burnout in therapy and wanted to, you know, make a living this way.
Uh-huh. And then how do you get out?
So it was kind of just like a cascade of things falling into place. You know, when I was given the daylight shift and not having to swing shifts anymore, I kind of like really stabilized and life got a lot better. And so I was able to kind of work towards goals, both in writing the book and also, you know, I was applying for jobs in kind of the teaching fields. And I just happened to be given a chance.
Well, you weren't afraid anymore.
No.
You just kept applying.
Yeah. And it was, you know, I think that it gave me the confidence that I had been lacking for such a long time. And also I think that when you work in a steel mill and you like, you know, you've stirred the pot of molten zinc or you've run the crane or the forklift, like, you know, you kind of say like, well, why can't I teach? I can do all of these other things, you know.
What was the most dangerous job you had?
I would say probably the most dangerous was the stirring this pot of molten zinc, which, like, when we say a pot of molten zinc, it's about the size of a small swimming pool.
Right.
Of this, like, 800-degree metal that, you know, you have, like, a long garden hoe and you're kind of pushing these impurities that form on the surface around. And, like, basically you're on, like, this platform that's suspended above this pool of metal. And, you know, there are supposedly lanyards that you're supposed to kind of tie yourself off so you can't fall in. But when I ask people about the lanyards, they're like, oh, no, people don't use those. Like, you know.
Like, why?
Well, yeah. So, yeah.
And, but, you know, moving on, you made so much money in the mill, you weren't going to replicate that in a teaching job.
No, and it was a hard decision to make because not only the money, but the benefits are so great. And yeah, it's something I still question whether I made the right decision to leave. But it seemed like just everything was kind of moving towards putting me on the path to teaching and being just full-time writer-teacher.
How did you come? Did you keep writing during all of this time?
Yeah. I was writing, like, a lot of the book was written while I was still at the mill. You know, I would work all day, and then I would come home and do my chores and then write way into the evening. And so it was grueling, but it was worth
it. Well, it explains how you could have so much detail, because I sort of wondered about that, whether you journaled or were actually writing it.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes I would just kind of go home and jot stuff down that I remembered or that struck me. But, yeah, a lot of the book was written while I was still there.
And did you write for other publications at the time just to start getting published?
Before I was at the mill, I did a lot of, like, smaller, like, academic journals. I had gotten a piece in the Best American Essays also, which was huge. So it was kind of just always this, like, slow progression towards kind of, you know, becoming a writer and, you know, earning my keep, I guess, that kind of culminated then in this book.
We've talked a lot about you being a teacher, but you're a writer.
Yeah, that's my prime thing. And I think that teaching kind of supports writing, both, you know, because you're with people who are doing similar things, kind of is motivating, and it also kind of gives you a little bit of time to work on your own things.
You're, like any great memoir, is very honest. It's feels and reads very authentically, and it's not altogether kind about everybody, including your family. But it doesn't feel mean. It just feels true. I think this is something people always wonder, how'd your family take this?
Yeah, I was definitely most concerned about that. I wanted to be as honest as I could, like you said, but sometimes, you know, people don't want to see themselves honestly portrayed. Sometimes that can be scary. But, you know, when I was writing the book, I didn't think too much about that. I just tried to be true to the story. But thankfully, my family has actually received it very well. You know, my parents are still both very supportive, and Tony as well.
And what about what your dad, you know, your dad was anti-union, mm-hmm. and here you're benefiting largely because of the unionization of the shop. How did he come to respond to what you were doing and the fact that you're working in a union?
No, I think that he was, you know, happy that I found this great paying job and that it kind of, like, launched all these other good things in my life, and overall very supportive. He actually came down to Columbus with me today.
Oh, so great. Is he out there? Is he here right now? Oh, okay. Hang on. Tim, hi Tim, you're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing?
Good.
I had a question. How are you able to work for the steel mills when, having a mental health capability, you can't work with heavy machinery?
Okay, yeah, with the mental illness, was that a problem?
No, actually, it wasn't a problem. You know, there are some medications that you might not be able to take, but the mill, they have a medical facility, so they were aware both of my mental illness and of the medications that I was on. And so I was allowed to, like, run a 100-ton crane and the forklifts.
They didn't hinder. It wasn't like they made you sleepy or anything like that.
No. And, you know, really, you know, people with mental illness can do pretty much anything anybody else can do. It's just, yeah, you know, it's more a matter of just managing yourself and, mm-hmm. yeah.
Tim, thanks for that call. We appreciate it. What about the college that you attended in Steubenville and the Catholic Church in general? Have they responded to anything you've written?
No, not that I'm aware of. I know that I think I was on the Today Show, and they called the Franciscan University of Steubenville for a comment that was just basically said, we don't comment on these types of things.
Right.
And, you know, I guess, yeah, I haven't heard anything really from them and I haven't been in contact. So I don't know how much they have read or, yeah, understand of my story.
There was a scene that you described toward the end of the book about going to the Women's March on Washington after, in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be 3 years ago. And the union organized the trip. And at first you weren't going to go. And then you changed your mind. Tell me about what happened on that trip.
Yeah, I'm definitely an introvert, so all those kind of big group things scare me a little bit. But I decided to go, and I was really glad that I did, not only because it just felt great to be with my fellow union sisters on this trip, but also I think just seeing the people converging on Washington and really, like, it felt like a message of kind of love and acceptance and, you know, kind of standing up for what we believe. And it felt just very powerful and very... very different than I think the prevailing political voices right now. Yeah.
I don't think I wrote it down in here, but it did sort of, it was a kind of a lot of closure in the sense that you did feel good about being a woman.
Yeah.
Which is what that priest had told you to do.
Yeah.
Back then.
Yeah, because, you know, I was supposed to pray to the Virgin Mary as my penance after the sexual assault and ask her to help me love myself as a woman. And I felt like in that moment, even though I maybe didn't pray my penance or, you know, didn't go to church as much anymore, that I had kind of come into my own as a woman and being able to stand up for my rights and what I believe.
It was also sort of Alice through the looking glass, too, because you were a union woman, you know, and facing off against anti-demonstrators. There who were on all kinds of issues, but mainly the abortion issue. You were coming at it from a different point of view as that as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, when I was in college wanting to become a nun, I did go to some anti-abortion rallies. And, you know, I think it made me realize just how sometimes narrow our thinking is in many ways. Like, you know, a lot of the people at this women's march were saying that, you know, I was going to hell and all of these types of things. And I think that, you know, we just need to have more compassion towards one another. And that, you know, that's what turns hearts, I guess. And kind of made me realize that, you know, my own views, maybe when I was younger, were a little myopic and narrow-minded. Yeah.
It could have been you on the other side of that divider. What, do you miss the mill?
I do, yeah.
What do you miss most about it?
I miss a lot of just the kind of, you know, sitting back and talking with people. And I also miss, like, there's something really nice about physical jobs where you're just kind of in the moment and you're also, like, paying attention to what's around you. You know, when you're teaching and writing, it's a lot of being in your head, a lot of thinking. And so there's something just refreshing about moving your body and seeing a finished product, or, you know.
I loved all the characters that you brought out.
Oh, yeah. There are some definite characters. One that comes to mind is Dynamo, who was an old-timer who had worked in the mill probably like 40 years and liked to make model cars and would always talk about his model cars.
Yeah. There was another one. Is it Sad Eyes or Sleepy Eyes?
Sleepy Bear.
Sleepy
yeah.
Bear.
Yeah.
What about him?
Oh, I spent a lot of time with Sleepy Bear. We were like partners for a while I was in the mill. And, you know, he would just nap sometimes, you know, like just be out like a light. And so we spent a lot of time just, you know, I spent a lot of time listening to his snores. But we were also very, like, you know, always looking out for each other, and you know, he would bring me his wife's cooking, and I would always bring him water bottles when I went to the other shanty. And, you know, it's just kind of a friendship there.
Well, Elise Goldbach, thanks for joining us today to share these stories. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Elise Goldbach, her new book is titled Rust, A Memoir of Steel and Grit. She will be at Gramercy Books in Bexley tonight. Go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.